Now, if a farmer won't sell, they get armed men to try to frighten him off. The farmers left because of fear. Because if they would not sell their land, their lives would be taken. They would be killed. Now that the company has taken over my land, I am not able to continue planting because the company is going to use it. Since there is really nothing more I can do there, I came here to live in the city. I have no job. My children are really hungry. My only wish is that they can eat at least one meal a day.
3 out of 4 Philippine children under age 5 are malnourished. Yet over half the food grown in the Philippines is exported.
When any kind of intensive agriculture program is undertaken, there will be some displacement and some movement of people, but the trade-offs, it would seem, in every place that they have occurred, that we're familiar with, are to the side of the plus.
The movement of hundreds of millions of peasant families from their farms to the enormous urban centers of the Third World is the largest mass migration of people in all history.
What happens when multinational agribusinesses come into Third World countries? What happens to the people? This is our spotlight tonight on Alternative Views. Centerpiece of Alternative Views this evening is a devastating but very informative documentary called The Business of Hunger. It looks at what happens when multinational corporations come into third world countries and kick farmers off of their land. Where do they go? What do they do? What are their options? In this documentary, you'll see church people, the peasants themselves, the farm workers from 3 continents. And we'll also get agribusiness point of view as well. They think it's a good thing. We'll look at specifics such as what it takes to put peanut oil on the tables in Europe and what it does to the land as a consequence, as well as the people, and how the people fight back with riots and uprisings and how the governments try to suppress them. Well, we'll see this wonderful documentary later. But now we have some news stories to present to you.
Well, you remember the days during the Chernobyl disaster in the Soviet Union when their nuclear power plant caused so much troubles over there? Well, the American media spokespeople were saying all the time that, well, it couldn't happen here because we have safe nuclear power plants. And anyway, the Chernobyl plant doesn't have a containment vessel, and so ours do, so ours is safe. So don't worry, people. Well, the Public Citizen magazine, which is the Ralph Nader publication, has made a study of this, and it indicates that some U.S. nuclear power plant designs bear a striking resemblance to the Soviet plant. The federal government knew of the design flaws in the American plants 15 years ago, but it kept the information secret, and it took a Freedom of Information Act activity and a request and intervention with Congress in order to pry this information out. It seems that the containment buildings in 49 U.S. commercial plants might rupture or fall down in a major accident, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. Although there are some differences between the American plants and the Chernobyl plant, they all use a containment system known as pressure suppression. And the ironic thing is that even though the American plants have similar safety systems as those in the Soviet Unions, the Union Concerned Scientists report says that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows the plants to run with the hydrogen control systems off. Another indication of the really seriousness of this whole thing is that there is a reactor only 30 miles from New York City. Now, you can imagine what would happen if they had a similar situation occur there as it did in Chernobyl, which was, what, 60 miles from Kiev, and they had to evacuate an enormous area and so many people were killed. What would happen if this occurred in that Indian Point reactor in New York City, or the one, the Shoreham plant in Long Island? It's incredible.
In fact, Frank, as a result of that, there's been a real step up on the anti-nuclear movement in New England. There was an article in these times that there's been some massive demonstrations and increased concern about safety in the United States around these new nuclear power plants that are being built. There's another story in these times on September the 2nd that is even more disturbing than some of the stories about the danger of radiation from the nuclear power plants in the United States, and that is the story of a cover-up of a leak of radiation from an underground nuclear test that took place in Nevada this year, the same month as the Chernobyl disaster in the Soviet Union. On April the 10th of this year, at the nuclear weapons test site in Nevada, there was an underground weapon test codenamed Mighty Oak that somehow got out of control and released tremendous amounts of nuclear radiation into the atmosphere that they tried to bottle up in an underground test tunnel, and something like $20 million worth of equipment was destroyed. And then they had to release the radiation over the next month in what they called controlled ventilating. Critics of the nuclear testing program have indicated that the government never really released the full extent of the danger from the radiation leakage from this test, and from the very beginning tried to cover up the fact that it even happened. When Harry Reid, who's a Democratic representative from New York, heard of this accident, he called the Department of Energy, who assured him that nothing out of the ordinary had happened. Then when he followed up on this and asked for a full accounting of what happened, they refused to honor the request. But over the next month, different reporters and anti-nuclear activists got a lot of the facts of what happened from workers on the test site who admitted that an accident had happened that was very serious in this nuclear weapons underground test, and that a lot of radiation had been vented into the atmosphere. And they finally admitted that the tunnel and the whole test site was dangerously contaminated and would probably never be usable again. Moreover, a Toronto-based scientist, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, indicated that much of the venting of the radiation from the underground tunnel occurred 2 days after the Chernobyl accident in the Soviet Union, from April the 28th to the 30th, in an attempt to try to make it appear that the higher degrees of radiation in the atmosphere in the United States were a result of the Soviet accident. So this is a pretty sleazy thing. And the Green Party, indicated that in France at the same time there was a similar disguised venting from a nuclear reactor mishap at Cap de la Hague in France. The French evidently also used the Chernobyl disaster as a pretext to vent radiation into the air to again try to blame it on the Soviets. The In These Times article also indicates that the government has never really released figures as to the full extent of accidental test radiation leakages. They've been carrying out underground nuclear weapons tests since the 1950s, and evidently there's been many more accidents in these underground tests than have been previously reported. As recently as 1979, for instance, Congress was told that there were only 19 incidents of underground test accidents since the nuclear program started, but the amount has been updated since then. Retired Air Force Colonel Raymond Brim, for instance, told a House committee that, and I quote him directly, "The American people have not received the true facts regarding nuclear fallout from these underground weapons tests. And in response to his charges, test site officials have recently revised the number of accidental releases upwards to 40, and more recently the official figure has been revised upward again, first to 62 and now to 72. So there's been at least 72 accidents in these underground nuclear weapons tests where an unacceptable amount of radiation was vented into the atmosphere. Critics of the underground nuclear weapons testing also indicate that the geological stability of the test site area in Nevada has been grossly weakened by the hundreds of atomic tests conducted there over the years, and have indicated that of the last six tests, three have gone awry. There's been unacceptable leakage in three of the last six tests in Nevada that indicate that there's something terribly wrong with this underground nuclear weapons testing program. And this is particularly frightening since there's been estimates that up to 1,000 underground tests have been projected for Nevada in the next 10 to 20 years. So at a time when the Soviet Union is calling for a moratorium on underground nuclear tests, this seems like a good time for the U.S. to look at its underground weapons testing program, because it appears increasingly dangerous that we're going to have a disaster that will result from this underground testing.
Well, it's rather ironic. Perhaps the Reagan administration official was telling the truth rather than evading the query of the reporter when he said nothing unusual happened.
Right, but that's a sarcastic commentary.
Over the years, we have found articles from people, and people who've been on the program have criticized the way that the government goes about determining the joblessness statistics. Anda Cormas in The Guardian has done some work in addition on this and shows that when the media come on and say, well, we have good news today, the job employment or the unemployment rate dropped to 7.9 from 8.0. Well, she says that that's really a bunch of hogwash. You can't believe it. Double that figure and you may have something close to what it really is. The Bureau of Labor Statistics misrepresents the unemployment and the employment situations. We know that. That's been happening for a long time. But even now, the BLS head, Janet Norwood, testified in Congress that she admitted that the unemployment rate was inaccurate. And a New York-based Council on International and Public Affairs looked into it and urged the creation of a commission on employment and unemployment to improve the quality of the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting. The CEPA, as they call the Council on International and Public Affairs, CEPA is a longtime critic of the Bureau, and it has been publishing its own statistics over the years for the past 15 years, and indicates that the Bureau of Labor Statistics usually underestimates by about one half what the unemployment rate usually is. For one thing, the unemployment rate is done on a monthly survey of 59,000 households. It also surveys 250,000 business establishments, collecting the number of workers on payrolls and other data which is used in computing the jobless rate. But if the small size of the sample affects the reliability of the national totals, and the tiny geographic and racial breakdowns are make the statistics just about worthless. For instance, in June it said there was a gain of some over 500,000 jobs for the month, reducing the civilian unemployment rate from 7.3 to 7.1. And the payroll survey showed a loss of 89,000 jobs. But for the same month, CEPA, using its particular way of analyzing the situation, said instead of 7.3, the unemployment rate should be 14.5. And an Iowa State University sociology professor looked into eight counties in Iowa on a very comprehensive basis and found that the joblessness rate there was 17.3. Now, this compared with the Bureau of Labor Statistics report of 6.5 in the same area. And, of course, the sample is so tiny that when they say that how much the unemployment rate for black youth is and other minorities is just impossible to tell. And the non-farm sector, for instance, the way they count somebody as unemployed also skews the reporting, because anyone who does 1 hour of paid work in a week is considered as employed. And in agriculture, anyone who works 15 hours in the week, whether they're paid or not, is counted as being employed. So they also count the 24 million part-time people, a quarter of whom can't even find other jobs. They'd like to work full-time, but they can't. They count them as fully employed. And they don't even count, the discouraged workers who've tried so long, they've just given up and said, heck with it. So, and you remember I was telling you about a person I know, I can't say who it is, but they do, their job is to do some of this surveying. And they've indicated that they and a lot of their people, co-workers, are really angry because the Reagan administration tells them to go and take their surveys at specific places where they know there will be high employment, and are directed to stay away from specific places they know of high unemployment. So the figures are useless.
Interesting. Frank, there's an article in these Times of August the 19th about a University of Michigan philosopher, Fritzof Bergmann, who has some proposals about what to do about the growing unemployment, particularly that unemployment due to automation and technological unemployment. Bergmann has done a study of the U.S. economy and labor system and tried to analyze what jobs and what type of jobs would be eliminated by computers and automation in the coming years, and concluded that in the future there's going to be an increasing shortage of jobs in the United States in the industrial sector. And if the U.S. wants to avoid a wide-scale disaster, complete unemployment in several industries, it must find a way to share the remaining jobs in the industrial sector rather than just allowing a few people full-time unemployment, in fact, and others employment. In fact, he studied in Flint, Michigan, where he's been living, the situation, and has discerned that whereas the unemployment rate stands at 30% in Flint, which is quite a high figure, another 30% of the workers regularly work 60 to 70 hours a week with a lot of overtime, so that if you shared the existing work rather than dividing it into two categories of one unemployed group and another employed group doing a lot of hours of work, you would solve the problem of unemployment. But he sees that more radical demands are going to be needed for the future, and proposes a more extensive job sharing program where in the industrial sectors, workers will be given 6 months of work and then a 6 month leave of absence, in which the cost for that would be shared by industry and the government to train them for a new job, or to send them back to college to learn new jobs or new educational skills. He has set up a Center for New Work in downtown Flint, Michigan, that is supported by unions and even by General Motors, to study how the workers can gain new skills and can be offered new job possibilities.
We'll have more news stories later after we see the documentary entitled The Business of Hunger.
I'm right here to tell you, mister, there ain't nobody gonna push me off my land. My grandpa took up this land 70 years ago. My pa was born here. We was all born on it. And some of us was killed on it. And some of us died on it. And that's what makes it iron. Being born on it and working on it and dying on it. And not no piece of paper with a writing on it.
My land was planted before in corn, coconuts, and rice. But 2 days ago, with no warning, these bulldozers showed up. It seems the government owns the land. We have no paper to prove it is mine. So now we have nothing. We have no more source of livelihood. Now a big company will plant pineapples on my land.
What company are you referring to?
I'm really going crazy because there is no food for my children.
When God created the world, He gave people land to till. And through the land, people are to survive here on earth and live a life that is proper of a human being, that is living a life of dignity. However, if these multinational corporations use the land for pineapple, then we deprive our people of the much needed land. So many thousands of families are going hungry because of the unavailability of land.
Multinational corporations now grow more food in Asia, Africa, and Latin America than ever before. But much of the food is exported, while over 500 million people go hungry. Many people believe that hunger is caused by drought, war, or overpopulation. But in the vast Sahel region in West Africa, there is another reason. Peanuts. A 100 years ago, French colonialists, who controlled most of the Sahel, forced farmers there to grow peanuts for the French vegetable oil industry. Peanut farming and processing by multinational corporations expanded rapidly after the Second World War. By the 1960s, peanuts were king of the Sahel. Over half the cultivated land of Senegal, 2.5 million acres, is now devoted to growing peanuts for export to Europe. Director of the United Nations Institute for Africa, Samir Amin.
Certainly throughout the history of the development of peanuts in Senegal, for a long time, for a whole century, the European consumer and European capitalism has been benefiting from peanuts. Certainly who suffered from the peanut first and before anybody else is the African peasant himself, who was compelled to work more to produce, in addition to his own subsistence, some peanuts, which were paid at a very low price. The low return on peanuts produced a huge migration to the cities in Africa, and the growing proportion of the population of those cities are really terrifically poor and are not, certainly not benefiting from the peanut industry.
Peanuts also deplete the soil. Peanut harvesting uproots the plants, since the nuts grow underground. The disrupted soil is gradually carried off by dry season winds. The small peanut farmers are too poor to replenish the soil with fertilizer, so they grow peanuts until the soil is exhausted, and then they move on, leaving barren land behind. Today, a terrible drought. The food storage bins in the villages are nearly empty. Malnutrition and famine are spreading.
The famine is not due to the drought. The drought has only revealed the seriousness of the situation, has aggravated it. But the desertification of the country by over-cultivating peanut throughout a whole century has been and is the main responsible for the deficiency in food agriculture today.
The vast estates in southern Brazil grow soybeans, which are processed locally into oil by large American companies such as Cargill, and then exported to Europe and Japan.
Food processing, extensive and intensive farming are part of progress, and they are part of a slow, step-by-step, measured progression of agribusiness improvement. This is what every country wants. This is what we are trying to bring to them.
The first large-scale soybean farming began in the state of Paraná.
Mas tivemos também a introdução de uma.
In this region, we've had a flood of agricultural technology.
E o resultado disso foi
the results of this were very serious social and ecological consequences. From the social point of view, intensive mechanization developed here. In the area of soybeans, this resulted in the expulsion of small farmers.
The displaced farmers used to grow staple crops here for local consumption, such as the common black bean. The land is now used for soy. So black beans have become scarce, and prices have gone up. A pound of black beans cost the average Brazilian one day's pay. A gallon of milk, 2 days' pay. In Brazil, 2 out of every 3 people don't get enough to eat.
If you take soy, for example, it's taking up presently roughly 25% of the area of basic plantations in the country. And this is enormous. Soy, which Brazil is exporting as oil, is obviously taking land from food crops. And this type of orientation of agriculture makes people hungrier.
The expansion of food exports from third world countries ironically grew out of an international effort to feed the people in those countries.
The story starts with the Green Revolution some 20 years ago, when the United States government and several foundations, so-called philanthropic foundations, transferred a lot of technology in terms of new seeds, fertilizer, and chemicals to the underdeveloped world and developed wheat and rice cultivation on a very large scale.
The new varieties of wheat and rice allow the increasing demands of a growing population to be satisfied.
The tools are there, and the battle against hunger can be won. Men of dedication and strong will see to it, because they must see to it.
Agribusiness companies quickly joined the Green Revolution to help feed the world. But critics such as Ernest Feder argue that the profit motive got in the way.
The capitalists who invested in third world grain production rapidly expanded into other fields. This included a whole variety of other products, such as fruits and vegetables, livestock, wheat and rice, don't earn the returns that high-value crops secure. Therefore, it is obvious that the transnational corporations push the type of crops which are the most remunerative for them. And they are obviously the export crops.
Agribusiness must make a profit. In fact, the term agribusiness means profit. Business means profit.
For the past 20 years, Gulf and Western, a U.S. multinational corporation, has grown, processed, and exported sugar from the Dominican Republic. They ended up controlling 85% of the economy of the eastern part of that country.
En el este, donde Gulf and Western tiene... In eastern Dominican Republic, where Gulf is based, there should be prosperity. But nevertheless, the statistics show that it's one of the areas with the highest level of malnutrition. Where there are the largest number of children who die at an early age. And where the people don't have the minimum resources to sustain themselves in a dignified and decent manner.
How long since you've eaten?
About a week. I get food in the streets or leftovers from restaurants where people give me a peso or half a peso. I am not working, and the government doesn't give me anything for my child. It doesn't help anyone, not even to cover the basic needs.
Gulf and Western no es el problema.
Gulf and Western is not the problem. The problem is the Dominican government. Our government, far from preserving our national interests by regulating investments, has opened its arms so that Gulf and Western plunders our country.
If the government fails to satisfy the growing demands of the people, the Dominicans will carry the struggle to a level that won't merely be equal to that in Central America. It will be even greater.
You know, the United States has allowed too often some of its largest multinationals control not only the economy, but the politics, the social structure, the military, everything, land policy of some of these third world countries. That's one of the reasons we're in the problem we're in Central America. Some of the reasons we've had problems around the world.
In the Philippines, the army patrols the countryside to crush rebellious farmers. It is a rebellion caused in part by the bitterness of farmers who have lost their land to multinational corporations. Del Monte, a U.S. agribusiness, is expanding its pineapple production onto land once cultivated by small farmers like this man.
Why should I not be angry? Especially for me, who was helping my mother here when Del Monte took away our land. Just because they are rich and they are enjoying their wealth, they still take our land away from us. Anyone would be outraged if their land was taken away like this.
The Philippine government makes money by acquiring peasant farmland and leasing it to foreign agribusiness. When peasants resist, the government resorts to extreme measures.
I sold my land because they asked me to, and I really had no choice. If I didn't sell it, they would keep on coming back to me until I finally gave in and sold out to the company.
Now, if a farmer won't sell, they get armed men to try to frighten him off. The farmers left because of fear. Because if they would not sell their land, their lives would be taken. They would be killed.
When any kind of intensive agriculture program is undertaken, there will be some displacement and some movement of people, but the trade-offs, it would seem, in every place that they have occurred, that we're familiar with, are to the side of the plus.
The movement of hundreds of millions of peasant families from their farms to the enormous urban centers of the Third World is the largest mass migration of people in all history.
I have always been a farmer. My crops were coffee, coconuts, and cocoa. Now that the company has taken over my land, I am not able to continue planting because the company is going to use it. Since there is really nothing more I can do there, I came here to live in the city. I have no job. My children are really hungry. My only wish is that they can eat at least one meal a day.
3 out of 4 Philippine children under age 5 are malnourished. Yet over half the food grown in the Philippines is exported.
God created the land for all. For all, we read in the Bible. When a man is working the land during years, to put this man for the surprises of the cities, it is a great sin against God and against the human creature.
Millions of peasants whose land has been taken over by agribusiness end up in a desperate struggle against hunger. Children are often the first victims of a society where a higher priority is placed on exporting food than on feeding local people first. This child's condition is critical. He has third-degree malnutrition. It represents a degree that is very critical. The child died a few days later.
I have the firm conviction that if we don't modify the economic policy of our country in a way to improve things, to give more attention to the internal necessities of the people here, then we will bring our country to an even bigger internal crisis.
American population needs is to understand that the gravity of the problems, take two-thirds of the population going hungry, is so great that transformations must be started, and the support for these transformations, the support of the American public, is extremely important.
At some point, we're going to have to realize that our foreign policy has to be based on a sense of social justice, but our allies are going to have to face that too.
I think the best thing that the United States could do is to withdraw from the Third World agricultures and leave these countries to their own resources.
The abandoned wreckage of an American agribusiness called Bud Antle, which expanded into Senegal in 1972. Advanced irrigation technology was used to grow green beans for export to Europe. In 1976, when the operation was no longer profitable, they abandoned their estate and left Senegal to figure out what to do about it.
It is possible that in the beginning, this would present for the Third World grave problems. But on the other side, it would be an extremely important challenge to organize their production, their processing, and their nutrition for themselves.
In the past few years, local farmers have taken over what had been the Bud Antle estate. They have formed a cooperative for growing and selling their crops. Some of what they grow is for their own consumption, some is for local markets.
You cannot continue to promote a development that has foreign roots. You have to base development on local forces. What I think is that you have to turn things over, start from local necessities, like the developed countries have made, respond to the local necessities, and then organize your exports, organize your foreign relations according to the logic of your surplus and not to the logic of what is being needed in northern countries.
These farm laborers in northwest Mexico don't work for a foreign agribusiness. They own the land they work on. 5,000 landless peasants fought for and took over 50,000 acres of idle farmland here. Peasant leaders recognized that they could not go back to each family farming their own small plot of land. They saw that modern farm technology makes for efficient food production. So they worked their land as one large cooperative farm, each member owning a share of the business. They have started a small industry for building their own houses. They have their own schools and their own credit union.
La coalición de ejidos representa para la familia campesina.
For the peasant family, our coalition represents economic and social freedom, as opposed to their traditional oppression. Before, we were all day laborers, and we were unable to have many things we deserved for the jobs we did on the farms owned by others. Now we have the land, and we receive what we are owed, the fruits of our labor.
The sooner we let these third world countries work out their own problems, the better it will be for these countries and even for the industrial countries. If we don't, I think our system will be totally incapable, if it is not already totally incapable, to resolve the problems, the catastrophic problems of hunger, unemployment, and poverty.
In Columbus, Ohio, people at a food cooperative are alerting their community to the problems of hunger in the third world.
Our food cooperative imports products from the third world. Products like dried pineapple, dried banana chips. And as we have learned more about the food distribution in the world, we've learned that many of these products are brought into the United States from countries that experience significant malnutrition. We developed a strategy of taxing those items that we import from third world countries and using the revenues from that tax to educate ourselves and people in our communities about food and hunger issues.
Groups such as this Bread for the World chapter in Memphis, Tennessee, are lobbying members of Congress to change U.S. policy toward the developing world.
I'm a dietitian. I have a very deep concern for malnutrition, and I'm afraid that what is happening in the more developed nations is that we are promoting malnutrition in these third world countries.
We are expecting the people in America to express also their faith to really help us by putting pressure on these multinational corporations. I think that is one way of expressing also our faith, putting pressure on these multinational corporations.
We can make a difference in overcoming hunger in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. We can demand that U.S. government and business policies in the third world give priority to feeding local people first. We can support movements by peasants to own their own land and grow their own food. In these ways, our brothers and sisters in the third world will have enough to eat and have a future for themselves and their children.
My only wish is that my children can eat at least one meal a day.
Time for some more news stories from the Alternative Press.
There's been a lot of debate in the media over the last several months as to whether the United States and Great Britain should impose economic sanctions against South Africa in an attempt to bring about changes there against the apartheid regime. And in South Africa itself, there's been a great outrage among blacks there in response to the Reagan administration's claims that the reason that they don't impose sanctions is because they're concerned with the blacks themselves, and that sanctions will hurt blacks more than anyone in South Africa. Bishop Tutu and others say this is gross hypocrisy, and that all the progressive black leaders in South Africa are calling for sanctions as the best means to force changes on the apartheid regime there. Now, both Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher claim that another reason why they're reluctant to impose sanctions is simply because they don't work. They don't bring about meaningful and significant political changes, according to Reagan and Thatcher. And in particular, Margaret Thatcher says the examples of the imposition of sanctions in Rhodesia in 1965 show that they fail to bring about changes against apartheid regimes. Well, according to an article in These Times, Margaret Thatcher is absolutely dead wrong on this point. 10 years after the sanctions were imposed against Rhodesia, finally the Rhodesians were forced to grant independence to their country and to have democratic elections for the first time, where the blacks won the majority of government. And according to analysts, including businessmen and politicians from Rhodesia, the overwhelming consensus is that the economic sanctions in Rhodesia forced the concessions that led to independence of that country and an end to apartheid there. There's several interviews in These Times with Rhodesian businessmen who point out that between 1965, when sanctions were first imposed, and 1966, Rhodesian exports fell in value by 38%, with tobacco one of the country's leading export earners, the biggest casualty. According to E.G. Cross, who was the economist for Rhodesia's Agricultural Marketing Authority from 1965 to 1980, the volume of tobacco fell by one-half, while its value declined by two-thirds. The conclusion that they reached in a study of the impact of sanctions in Rhodesia on the economy was that by the mid-1970s, Rhodesia had come to the crunch line, one businessman claimed. Growth was tapering off, new technology could not be obtained, and the lack of spare parts was an ever-present problem. Major industries, they say, were suffering in their volumes and in their prices, and that the country had run out of foreign currency, for the necessary inputs into new domestic industries. So businessmen in Rhodesia admit now that sanctions were the primary reason for forcing political changes on that country. And they also suggest that South Africa would even be more vulnerable to an economic boycott than Rhodesia because of the high level of technological development in that country that would grind to a halt with the imposition of sanctions that would make it impossible to get spare parts and more technological equipment for their industries. So the conclusion is that there's no question but that economic sanctions would have a meaningful effect on political developments in South Africa, and it's pure hypocrisy to claim that economic sanctions don't work and don't have any political effect, because the case of Rhodesia proves exactly the opposite. I might also note that there was an interesting article in the New York Times a few weeks ago that projected that the model of the transition from an apartheid settler regime in Rhodesia to an independent country in Zimbabwe, which is the new name for Rhodesia, would provide a very interesting model for a transition in South Africa, because the transition was effected in Rhodesia to Zimbabwe without great violence and has worked very well, in which whites and blacks have managed to get along together quite well. The parliament in Zimbabwe, it consists of both blacks and whites who have worked and cooperated together. There's been no nationalization of white property, little violence against whites, who indicate they're quite satisfied with the way the transition to independence has worked. And also, Zimbabwe has been something of an economic success story. The New York Times indicates the great advances in agriculture in that country at a time when there's widespread famine in the rest of Africa. There's been remarkable agricultural development in Zimbabwe, mainly as a result of the collective farms that have been established there, where black Africans were given farmland for the first time, and now they have millions of excess grain production, millions of tons of extra grain that they're able to export to other countries in Africa. So they've been a remarkable success story in Zimbabwe.
The double standard of Reagan administration is shown in that they badmouthed Nicaragua for shutting down La Prensa, one of the opposition newspapers, the most extreme opposition newspaper. But they haven't said a thing about Israel closing down Arab publications in the occupied zones particularly. One is a daily and one a bi-monthly magazine, were shut down in August. The publisher indicates that his newspaper is independent, that it's all owned and funded by himself, not by the PLO. As a matter of fact, he says it reflects positions that are opposite to the circles in the Palestine Liberation Organization. But it is strongly anti-American, anti-Israeli, but it's also anti-reactionary Arab, I mean, states like Jordan or Saudi Arabia. There was a three-judge high court which made this decision, and they did it behind closed doors. The court allegedly based its decision on information presented by Israeli authorities, but they wouldn't let the defense lawyers find out what the information was about or try to refute it. So, once again, no peep of suppressing. Oh, by the way, this is the fourth newspaper since 1980 to be suppressed. And there was also one in 1985 that was shut down by the Israelis.
In these Times reports that a Stanford University computer professional worried about nuclear war is suing Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger on the grounds that the nation's high-tech launch-on warning system is unconstitutional. Clifford Johnson, who holds a PhD in operations research, says that U.S. policy, nuclear policy, is so heavily reliant on an air-prone computerized warning system that no meaningful human intervention would be possible before a nuclear launch. This automatic decision, he argued, illegally usurps congressional powers and delegates presidential powers to the computer. Johnson wants the federal district court in San Francisco to declare that Weinberger's oath of office obligates him to forthwith cease and desist from operating his launch on warning capability and dismantling this computer so that human beings have control again over the nuclear launch system.
Hmm. We've reported before, and you may have heard about some court cases where a woman who is getting divorced is able to get compensation for the amount of money which she would have been able to get had she been able to remain married to the husband, particularly if she put the husband through school. Well, New York's highest court, according to a January 28th article by Jane Bryant Quinn, has taken a long step toward endorsing a concept of marriage, including its potential as a true economic partnership, where they're equal partners who contribute dollars and cents or whatever. If the marriage dissolves, then each partner, including a non-working spouse, is entitled not only to a share of the money on hand and the property on hand, but also in the potential earnings and the future earnings of each other's financial future. I've even seen this in military, where they're beginning to say that divorced wives might be able to have a portion of her ex-husband's military retirement. Well, so far this theory has been chiefly applied to future earnings of well-paid professionals such as doctors and lawyers, but it also could be applied to other types of things, licenses, to expectation of corporate career advancement. But different states now have been interpreting it differently. For instance, Michigan and Iowa treat the value of professional degrees as a form of property that should be divided. So if you put hubby through, he gets his degree, his medical degree, well, you get a bite of that. But New York went further in declaring that a wife owns a share in her husband's earning power even if she did not work while he went to school. Now, Arizona and Minnesota, wives have been reimbursed for the money that they invested in their husband's professional education, but denied any share of the future value of those degrees. And wives in Texas and Colorado might be compensated if there's enough property to cover the award, but where there's little property, which is often the case, a wife cannot collect on her husband's future earnings. It makes me wonder, I wonder if they could do the opposite. I wonder, for instance, where, like in a corporate or in a military setup, where the wife is considered an equal partner as part of the team, as in her executive husband, and say she gets drunk and sasses the boss and ruins the guy's career, I wonder if he can sue her for the earnings that he would have gotten if she hadn't sassed the boss. And that's Alternative Views for this evening. We'd like to thank our camera person, Eric Eubank, our audio man, Kevin L. West, the Mary Knoll Missioners for permitting us to use the wonderful documentary, The Business of Hunger, and of course, Austin Community Television, ACTV. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. We're very pleased at the response which Alternative Views gets around the country. We'd also like to urge you to support your public access system no matter where it is. The exercise of free speech is very precious. Good night.